Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
After pill to women 18 and older. Girls 17 and under will need a doctor's note to buy the pills, which are made by Bayer Pharmaceuticals. Supporters said the sales could cut in half the nation's 3 million annual unplanned pregnancies, but opponents argue that wider access might increase promiscuity, and they liken it to abortion. Mark Kaufman is covering the story for The Washington Post. And Mark, could you remind us what this morning after pill or Plan B is and how it works?
It's essentially a double dose of a traditional contraceptive. And the way that it works is within 72 hours after unprotected sex, it can effectively work as an emergency contraception. So it is something that advocates say can indeed prevent abortions and unplanned pregnancies in situations where a woman, either because of a contraceptive failure or because got carried away or whatever, was not protected.
Now, this age restriction here, too, let's talk about that for a second. We should say that this will be available without a prescription to women who are over 18.
18 and over, right.
So I think that's curious because I don't think there's other medication that really has that kind of restriction on it.
I think that there are one or two others, but yes, it is extremely unusual. It is kind of the FDA's effort to make a compromise of sorts. But in the real world, I think it would be fair to say that it probably won't make that much difference. When you think about it, all you need to do is get a friend to go in and buy it for you if you're 17, and then the other person is 18. The FDA really kind of turned itself into a pretzel on this one. They had not only the expert panel, but also their entire science staff saying that there's every reason to move forward with this. And then they had what they say were other kind of concerns that had been raised about what this, that there wasn't enough data regarding the effects on young gals. And so they used that as a reason to say that it shouldn't be done. I think that a lot of people watching this play out would say that that was maybe partially the reason why they were doing it, but partially the reason why was because politically, that was what they needed to do.
Mm. And the acting FDA commissioner, Dr. Andrew von Essenbach, said that there is not enough scientific evidence, right, for those under 18 to use this medication.
That's what he said. And I remember sitting through the advisory panel meeting, and there was a fairly limited amount of information about the effects on women below the age of 18 or 16, I think, was the cutoff there. But the truth is there was also nothing to suggest that it would be in any way physically harmful to gals under 17 or 18. The issue was more, should someone of that age be able to just walk into a drugstore and ask for the morning after pill?
What has been, I guess, the thrust of the debate here? If it has been proven to be safe for the most part, why has it taken so long?
This issue came before an FDA advisory panel more than 2 years ago, and these experts voted 23-4 to say that this is perfectly safe and should be allowed for over-the-counter use. What women were saying was that it was often very difficult to get a prescription in the time period that you need for it to be most effective. The opposition came from some social conservatives in Congress. There was particularly an organization called the Concerned Women for America, which is a very active kind of socially conservative movement or group here in Washington. Their argument was threefold. One was that it could increase and promote promiscuity. Two, a lot of people consider it to be abortion. The FDA does not. But these folks, a more conservative side, say, well, they consider this to be an extremely early abortion. And on the third side, it just became a very intense political issue. You had people like Hillary Clinton on one side, you had Tom Coburn on the other side, and they were kind of duking it out. And an interesting sidelight here, Bar Labs, despite the fact that they were not able to sell it OTC for a long time, told me that over the last 3 years, their sales have doubled almost every year. So all of the publicity about it has actually served to make it far more known to people and far more available, although at that point on a prescription basis.
Well, Mark, thanks very much for being with us.
You're quite welcome.
Mark Hoffman is a reporter for The Washington Post. Building on the courtship of evangelical Christians during President Bush's 2004 campaign, a group of evangelical leaders is reaching out to voters in states considered key to conservative victories in the upcoming midterm congressional elections. But not all evangelicals want to link their religion to conservative causes and the Republican Party. Among them is Randall Balmer. He's a professor of American religious history at Barnard College, and he's author of the book Thy Kingdom Come, An Evangelical's Lament. He argues that evangelical Christians move from the margins of American culture to the halls of power in Washington, D.C., demonstrates that they've lost their way. And Randall Balmer joins us. Professor Balmer, in your book, you talk about how the religious right started to gather around political issues, and you describe what you call the abortion myth, the story of how the religious right first came together politically around abortion.
The problem with this story is that it's, in fact, utterly false. The religious right, as I documented in the book, got together as a political movement, not in response to Roe v. Wade, but in response to a lower court ruling, Green v. Connolly, most people have never heard of, which, in fact, upheld the IRS movement against racially discriminatory educational institutions, and in particular, Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina. Once they had mobilized to resist the IRS actions against Bob Jones University, and this I have this directly from Paul Weyrich, one of the architects of the religious right, there was a conference call among these various leaders. Someone said, we have makings here of a political movement. What other issues can we address? Somebody said abortion, and that's how abortion was cobbled into the political agenda of the religious right in the late 1970s, not as a direct response to Roe v. Wade. You have evangelical Christians throughout history quoting the Bible to justify, for example, their support for slavery in the 19th century, their support for segregation as late as the 1950s and even beyond that. Whereas the Bible has some very clear things to say about, and Jesus himself has very clear things to say about care for the poor, for example. He has very clear things to say about being peacemakers. Jesus, on the other hand, says nothing whatsoever about either abortion or homosexuality. Jesus was pretty clear, and the Bible itself is pretty clear about divorce. And the Bible does not condone divorce. And what I find curious as a historian is that these denunciations of divorce disappear almost entirely from evangelicalism. Long about 1980, long about the same time that they decided to embrace Ronald Reagan, a divorced and remarried man, as their political savior, a man who, by the way, as governor of California, signed into law a bill legalizing abortion. I think there is a moral concern that lies behind the religious right's opposition to abortion. And by the way, I share that. So my point is simply that we, meaning people of faith such as myself, need to take into account the historical contingency of some of these issues.
Now, when we read about this courtship of evangelical voters and the voter registration drive that's being undertaken by evangelical leaders before the midterm elections that are coming up this fall, and you write in your book, quote, the coalition with the Republican Party is blasphemy, pure and simple. And you hear about these efforts that are being undertaken by some of the leaders of the evangelical church. I'm wondering, well, what's the reason for this division here, and what do you think about that?
My quarrel with the religious right is twofold. First of all, I think the religious right has distorted the gospel, the good news of the New Testament. They have taken something that is lovely and redemptive and turned it into something ugly and punitive. They've cherry-picked through the Bible and wrenched verses out of context to use them as a bludgeon against their political enemies. My second quarrel with the religious right is that, as a historian of American religious history, I recognize that evangelicals in the 19th century, and in fact into the 20th century, were very active on the part or on the behalf of those who were on the margins of society. They were active. They energized the anti-slavery movement. They were active in the temperance movement, which in the 19th century was a progressive cause. They pushed for universal, comprehensive public education, public schools. They are also pushing for the rights, including the voting rights for women. And try as I might, as I look at the actions and the agenda of the religious right at the turn of the 21st century, I don't see those concerns being echoed in that agenda. I do not argue in the book that people of faith should not make their voices heard in the arena of public discourse. I happen to believe that the arena of public discourse would be impoverished without those voices. But I do think there is real danger for the faith, for the integrity of the faith, when it is aligned too closely with a particular political ideology, a political party, or in this case, even a specific administration. Because I think at that point, the faith loses its prophetic power.
Can you give me a specific example of that? Where do you think that there is evidence that being too close to power might be too much of a compromise?
Let me give you an illustration. In the course of writing this book, I contacted 8 religious right organizations with a very simple, straightforward question. I wasn't trying to be querulous or to be contentious. I asked simply for these organizations to send me a copy of their group's position on the use of torture. Now, these are groups, as you know, that have detailed position papers on everything from same-sex unions to stem cell research and many other issues. I received a response from only 2 of those organizations, and both of those organizations defended the Bush administration's policy on torture. Now, these are people who claim to be pro-life. These are people who purport to hear a fetal scream, and yet they've turned a deaf ear to the very real screams of fully formed human beings who are being tortured in the name of this government. That's an example of what I'm talking about. When the faith becomes so identified with a particular party, or in this case, a particular administration, it loses its prophetic voice. It loses its power. My sense of American religious history is that religion always functions best from the margins of society, calling people in power to account rather than at the councils of power.
We're talking with Randall Balmer. He's professor of American religious history at Barnard College, and he's author of the book Thy Kingdom Come, An Evangelical's Lament. Just ahead, we look at how religion in America has flourished because of the separation of church and state. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at HERE-NOW.ORG. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, your phone number, and the town you're calling from. There's more coming up here and now. Come, An Evangelical's Lament. The book argues that many Christian leaders in the U.S. are too close to those in power. Professor Balmer, you also write about the fear of pluralism. Can you explain what you mean by that?
I think one reading of the religious right is that it is it organized as a response to pluralism, and I think I understand that. I think that's an understandable impulse. Here you have a movement or a faith or an ideology that for a good part of American religious history was almost hegemonic in its presence in American society. And then you have increasing pluralism in American society after the 1965 changes to the immigration laws, which literally recast the religious landscape of America. And I think one interpretation of the religious right is that the religious right is trying to change the rules of public discourse to their advantage because they want to enjoy a competitive advantage in this pluralistic context. I understand that. I think it's a very understandable impulse to want to do that. I also think it's very wrong because my sense of American religious history is that religion has flourished in this pluralistic context for more than 200 years. And religion has flourished in this pluralistic context because of the First Amendment, which effectively set up a free marketplace for religion, where you have in America, to extend the metaphor, religious entrepreneurs who are constantly competing with one another for popular followings. And this lends a populist cast to religion in America, but it also ensures that we have and we maintain to this day a very salubrious, vital, vibrant religious culture in America, and it's precisely because of this pluralism. So when the religious right comes along and wants to eviscerate the First Amendment, and they do, the religious right is, in fact, acting against its own self-interest, or at least acting against the interest of evangelicalism, because evangelicals have competed very, very well in this marketplace for more than two centuries, and try to undermine the First Amendment, I think, is a real mistake.
You also remind us, though, of our beginnings with Puritanism.
Yes, that's right. The whole First Amendment, the whole notion of separation of church and state, grew out of Puritanism. That is, as a reaction to Puritanism and the kind of theocracy that we find in 17th century Massachusetts. The founder of the Baptist tradition in America, Roger Williams, began life in the New World as a Puritan minister in Salem, Massachusetts. And very quickly, he became suspicious of this close alliance and collusion between church and state in 17th century Massachusetts. And his concern is the same as my concern. His concern was that, in his words, the garden of the church would be contaminated by the wilderness of the world unless there were, again in his words, a wall of separation between church and state. And Williams recognized, and Williams became the founder of the Baptist tradition in America. This is a fundamental bedrock Baptist principle, the notion of separation of church and state. Williams recognized the danger in fetishizing the faith if it became too reliant on the state for legitimacy.
What are your evangelical credentials?
Oh, my goodness. How much time do we have? I was born into an evangelical family. My father was a minister for 40 years in the Evangelical Free Church of America, so I grew up in parsonages all across the Midwest, from Illinois to Nebraska, Minnesota, Michigan, Iowa, and so forth. I went to Trinity College, Deerfield, Illinois, which was an evangelical school supported by that denomination, as well as to Trinity Evangelical Divinity School for an MA in church history before coming on to graduate school. But I want to add to that because evangelicals would insist rightly that the faith is not a birthright. I have had my own conversion experiences, which is one of the criteria for being part of evangelicalism. I honor the scriptures as the word of God. I believe in the transformative power of Jesus because I have seen and witnessed that transformative power in my own life.
Are you concerned that saying some of these provocative things will perhaps attract an attempt to discredit you and folks?
It's already begun.
It has.
Oh, certainly.
And you might be ostracized
from
your faith.
Sure. This is a risk, Deborah, that I recognize going into this. I mean, I knew that writing a book like this would be costly to me personally, and I've had all sorts of attempts to impugn my character and to deny that I'm an evangelical Christian and all that stuff. I expected that, and it's happened. But what I regret most is that so far, no one on the right has really engage the substance of my arguments. I hope someone does, and I'm willing to have that conversation anywhere and anytime.
On the other hand, are you finding, perhaps, that there maybe are more liberal evangelicals than you thought, and maybe you're getting some support?
I am getting support as well. Yes, absolutely. I would say that the mail is running probably nine or more to one in support. And what I'm hearing from a lot of evangelicals is a sense of relief. Finally, someone is articulating their uneasiness and their concern about the actions and the direction of the religious right. A lot of people have said, I've been waiting for somebody like you to stand up and to make a stand against what they agree are the distortions of the religious right. So I am getting that support, and I'm grateful for that as well, no question about it.
Randall Balmer, professor of American Religious History at Barnard College and author of the book Thy Kingdom Come, How the Religious Right Distorts the Faith and Threatens America, an Evangelical's Lament. He joined us from a studio near his home in Connecticut. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Just ahead, it's back to school season. We look at what's happening in some communities. Many are rethinking the middle school experience. And tomorrow, why do kids have homework? One author says they don't need it. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, promoting engineering and technological
literacy. Never come out because their test scores plummet as they struggle with physical and emotional changes that transform children to young adults. Several school districts think they've come up with a resolution: keep students in elementary school longer. Cities from Boston to Memphis have made or are making this change. They're closing middle schools and going to kindergarten through grade 8. The nonprofit Philadelphia Education Fund has helped many cities, including Philadelphia, make this change. Dr. Liza Herzog is a lead researcher there, and she joins us along with Laverne Wiley, who's principal of the John Welsh Elementary School in Philadelphia. Her school made this conversion to K through 8 4 years ago. Dr. Herzog, let's start with you. How widespread is this move from middle school to K through 8 schools?
We are seeing cities go toward this new model, which is the K-8 model, and away, moving more so away from middle schools.
But why is the conversion taking place?
Well, I think it's taking place for several reasons. The idea behind the movement, I think, was really to create more caring learning environments for adolescents. It's often a very turbulent time developmentally for kids that are, you know, 10 through 14 and going through all sorts of cognitive and emotional changes. And the thought behind it was really that, I mean, it's common sense, really. If we reduce class and school size and foster personalization, kids will be more involved, they'll have a stronger relationship with a caring adult. But it, really the thought behind it was to, as you mentioned, help address what was often called the struggling middle, where kids, there was a real marked drop-off in student achievement between elementary and high school, and middle school was often left untended to.
Principal Wiley, let's go to you. I'm wondering, what are you seeing now that you've added those grades? Does it seem to help those older kids?
And what about absolutely. I think what Dr. Herzog had mentioned really has made a big impact. I was a middle school teacher, and we brought all these children together at that age where we know what adolescence is like, so there was a lot of problems. I find that with the conversion, it did help the students maintain that closeness and that nurturing environment with the staff.
But Principal Wiley, just on that same thought in a way, there's a police officer on site at your school, isn't there? Students are randomly checked for weapons. So there are some issues there, and obviously issues that might concern parents of a six-year-old as opposed to parents of a 13-year-old.
I think that was a big question when we did decide to convert. One of the things, I guess, is a little bit positive is the fact that we are a community school, so the kids know each other. All my children walk to school. I don't have any busing. One of the things that I did immediately was I didn't want my upper-grade kids to feel that, you know, they weren't moving on and they were a little bit different. what I did was I didn't want to create another middle school within my school and have the two grades, the two schools kind of isolated. So what I did was basically divide my middle grades, my 7th and 8th grades, on two different floors, but they are two opposite ends. We don't allow them essentially to kind of move from class to class on their own, except if they're if they don't have to go to a class on a different floor, the teacher kind of moves with them.
What benefit, then, do some of the younger kids get from all of this? Is there a mentoring program in place, and are they in contact with some of these older kids?
One of the things that we've tried to do at our school, and we have been successful at our school, is that we encourage our older children to be mentors or buddy readers with our primary grades. So during the lunch periods, kids get a service learning button, and they sign up to be a mentor to that classroom.
And it would seem to me that there could maybe be some drawbacks as well for some of the older students. So while they may be in a more nurturing environment, there may not be some of the resources for them that they would have in a middle school or a school design for just kids that age, say some of the sports resources or wood shop or those things that older kids generally tend to do, and what does that do to their overall educational experience?
And that has been an issue. Not only that, I think we don't have lockers. I mean, so part of the facilities don't accommodate the middle school student, and we try to alleviate that by partnering with schools that are close in proximity where the kids can either walk to do football or to do baseball or something of that nature, those kinds of activities.
Hmm. And also, what about making the transition to high school? Do we know at this point how the kids do in terms of making that transition? Is it harder going from a smaller K-8, more nurturing environment to then go into high school? Or?
In Philadelphia, and I'm not sure nationally how this is taking place, but I know in Philadelphia many of our comprehensive high schools started academies, 9th grade academies and 10th grade academies. So the kids were basically isolated with a certain number of teachers that they saw on a consistent basis, so the transition would be a lot smoother.
That's right. These are also nationally, they're called, as well, they can be small learning communities.
Small learning communities, right, or academies.
And exactly. It eases that transition and keeps them in that grouping where mm-hmm. they feel a real sense of,
belonging and being able to touch bases.
That same sort of environment, exactly.
Environment.
So they ease in.
Can you remind us, where did this, the model that we know now, the middle school model of the 6 through 8, grade 6 through 8, come from?
I think, only because I was a middle school teacher during that time, I think they thought that bringing all those students together as a group would be more beneficial for their social development and academic development, and I think it kind of probably had the opposite effect.
So, Dr. Herzog, is there evidence to suggest that the kids will do better in K through 8?
Well, I think you hit it on that. We're constantly searching for evidence. There is a growing body of evidence, and this is really both anecdotal and empirical, that K-8s have had some success in getting kids to come to school more and helping them engage while they're there. There's also recent research out of Hopkins that touches on behavioral, the kind of what they call the chaos factor, that it really is reduced dramatically and that individual attention is paid to struggling students much more. But they're really careful to call attention to, the size difference is not the silver bullet, that of equal importance our support for teachers and its school curriculum, and that all things working together really help nurture, a strong school. But the evidence is showing that there are positive student outcomes that are related to a school being a K-8.
All right. Well, thanks very much to both of you for being with us.
Thank you so much
inviting
me.
Dr. Liza Herzog is with the Philadelphia Education Fund. Laverne Wiley is principal of the John Welsh Elementary School in Philadelphia. You're listening to Here and Now. In the clash over the cosmos, Pluto is the latest casualty. After a week of meetings, the International Astronomical Union today issued historic new guidelines for defining a planet, and Pluto did not make the cut. So the solar system is now downsized to 8 so-called classical planets. Kelly Beatty is a planetary science specialist with Sky and Telescope magazine, and lately he's been here and now's eyes on the skies. Kelly, we spoke with you last week when the same group was talking about adding 3 new planets, but now Pluto's gone. What happened?
Well, I would have told you then that it ain't over till the fat lady sings, and that certainly proved to be the case. This was a really contentious issue from the get-go. And, it's been an active debate within the planetary science community for a couple of years now. But the discovery 2 years ago of an object called, being nicknamed Zena, which is bigger than Pluto, really brought it all to a head. And the astronomers had to make some kind of decision this time. The fact that they started out with a recommendation that would have been very inclusive and ultimately led to having lots and lots of things called planets backfired. And so the attendees at the conference, there were about 2,000 of them, this was in Prague, Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic, decided that they really wanted a definition that did not include Pluto, and we saw that played out this morning.
So now there's a new definition, then, of exactly what a planet is. Can you briefly explain what that is?
Sure. First of all, it has to orbit the sun. Second of all, it has to be massive enough to have pulled itself into a round shape. So it's not just a fragment of a collision, for example. And finally, it has to have cleared the neighborhood around its orbit. What that means is, let me try to explain. Suppose you're in a playground full of kids and there are three or four really mean, nasty bullies on the playground. You're going to avoid those people. Well, in a sense, planets are the bullies of the solar system. They clear away, through their gravity, other small objects in their vicinity. And that's the third criterion for major planethood.
And so, in this case, Pluto wasn't a bully enough to meet the requirements.
Absolutely. In fact, Pluto's only about two-thirds the size of our own moon. The planet Neptune, next in, has a moon called Triton, which is almost a clone of Pluto in terms of size and composition, and we'd think nothing of calling it a moon. But because Pluto was discovered circling the sun, and in particular because it was discovered in the intentional search for a planet back in 1930, the PR campaign at that time to name it a planet caught hold, took root, and we've been living with it for 75 years.
Now, how about the mnemonic device that I remember when learning the planets, right? My very earnest mother just serves us 9 pizzas. I mean, what will school children do now?
Right. Just to remind people, that's a way to remember the names of the planets outward from the sun. My very educated mother stands for Mercury, Venus, Earth, and so forth.
Right.
I think we would just adjust it this way. My very educated mother just served us nachos.
There you go.
And that would work. but you know, more seriously, there is a little bit of a problem here. The astronomers are really confusing the situation in this sense. We call the sun a star, and we think of a star as a whole range of different kinds of objects. Technically, the sun is a dwarf star, but we still consider it a star. Well, that's not what they did with Pluto. They said, a planet is a planet, it's one of these 8 objects, and Pluto, we're going to call it a dwarf planet, but that's not the same as a planet. And it may be, in the end, more confusing than it's clarifying, and I predict we haven't heard the last on this subject.
Oh, and what about the NASA spacecraft that's headed to Pluto? It's supposed to take, 9 years to get there, and now Pluto isn't a planet anymore.
Well, it's no less an interesting place to visit. I mean, here we have, and in fact, some of the characteristics of Pluto were what prompted this mission, which is called New Horizons in the first place. It's large enough to have an atmosphere. In a sense, it goes through seasons. It probably has something akin to a polar caps. It's got 3 satellites. And so for all those reasons, it's a fascinating world to study, whatever you want to end up calling it.
Kelly Beatty, planetary specialist with Sky and Telescope magazine. Kelly, thanks again for speaking with us.
Our pleasure. Thanks.
Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now.
It is no hand, no foot, no arm, no face, nor any other part belonging to a man. Oh, be some other name. What's in a name? That which we call a rose. By any other name would smell as sweet.
That's an excerpt of the balcony scene from Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, Act 2, Scene 2, performed by actress Olivia Hussey. Though words such as these have made playwright, actor, and poet William Shakespeare renowned for centuries, no one can say for sure what he looked like. Some people, for that matter, don't even believe that he was the one who wrote the plays and the poems credited to Shakespeare. We'll save that debate for later, but let's get back to his face. A new exhibit at Yale University's Center for British Art displays a series of possible portraits of the Bard, which you can see at our website, here-now.org. Searching for Shakespeare originated at the National Portrait Gallery in London and is making its only U.S. appearance this summer. The exhibit also features rare books and papers that illuminate Shakespeare's life. Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa recently visited the show with curator Elizabeth Fairman, who organized the Yale exhibit.
This bay, which is the first bay of the exhibition, we have some of the very important primary documents that relate to Shakespeare's life. Probably the most important one is the parish register, which records earlier in the volume Shakespeare's baptism. But because it was on display for over 100 years in the Holy Trinity Church in Stratford, you can't even see the signature anymore except under black light. So we've opened it to the baptismal record of his daughter Susanna, which is interesting because she was born 5 months after Shakespeare and his wife were married, so it was obviously a quick service. And above we have the marriage bond, which is also dated and sort of goes along with that bits of information.
How much do we know about Shakespeare the man?
We don't know much, and the nice thing about the exhibition is we do gather together as much as we can, and in the end it's the words of his plays that make him, I think, most human.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them. To die, to sleep no more, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. It is a consummation devoutly to be wished, to die, to sleep.
We are in the Contender Portrait Bay. We know that there were two portraits of Shakespeare that we think looked like him. As you go into the exhibition and the outside bay, you see the first folio, which is open to the portrait of Shakespeare by Martin Druschaut. We think that was a likeness that was acceptable to his family because it was done shortly after his death. The other image that's just at the outside of the exhibition is his tomb effigy, and we presume because his wife was still alive, she would have approved that image. But what we're looking for in this exhibition are the portraits that may have been done during Shakespeare during his lifetime. And so those are what we call the contender portraits. The first shows a very handsome young man in a silk doublet. It's known as the Grafton portrait. And it's possible that it's Shakespeare, but we think that the costume is too fancy.
Too fancy, why?
Because there were laws in the Elizabethan times that only certain members of the nobility could wear silk and velvet. And this color, this scarlet, could only have been worn by a very high nobleman. Shakespeare was not a very high nobleman. He may have played one as an actor, but he wasn't allowed to be painted as one. On the far right is the Sanders portrait, again, very possible portrait. Both of them authentic Elizabethan era portraits, there's no doubt about that. But to our eye, the man in the Sanders portrait may be too young to be Shakespeare. So the one that we're Well, we'll never be absolutely positive, but the Chandos portrait, the one in the middle, which shows Shakespeare, as we remember, rather bohemian, rather rakish, the age is right. We can't be positive, but we think that it's most likely that the Chandos portrait may have been Shakespeare and painted during his lifetime.
I've read that this one wasn't a very popular contender previously.
By the late 18th century, he was considered way too swarthy, way too non-English looking, even too Jewish looking to be acceptable.
That's not the Jew eyes. That's not the Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions. Fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is.
In the next room over, we also have Shakespeare's will. How rare is it to see this?
I don't think it'll ever leave Britain again. It belongs to the National Archives in Britain and is certainly an iconic document. I mean, to give it an equivalent might be something like a copy of the Declaration of Independence. This was an actual document that we know William Shakespeare held. He signed it on all three sheets. His signature is very shaky. We know he was on his deathbed. I think it is a very symbolic document.
One of the most famous stories about Shakespeare's will is the fact that he left his second best bed to his wife.
Right.
Did that mean anything?
People have thought, oh, this means he didn't love her. We just don't know. But we think it's possible that she brought that bed to the marriage and then he just wanted to be sure that she got it. It's assumed that she would have lived with the first daughter who got most of his estate so that there wouldn't have been a worry on her part of being supported.
In looking at this will, we're reminded that Shakespeare, unlike a lot of people who go into the arts or go into the theater, actually made money.
He did. He was a very clever businessman, and one of the arguments that he couldn't have written the plays was that how could he also have been such a great businessman?
So I have to ask you, where do you stand?
I think Shakespeare wrote the plays. There's just no question in my mind. His name was noted very early on the printings of the plays in the 1590s. He was known in London by 1592, mentioned by a couple of writers. So I think he was important in his own time. I think the assumption of this exhibition is that Shakespeare wrote the plays, and we're moving on to something else, something a little more pointed. That is, what did he look like?
That's Elizabeth Fairman, curator of rare books and manuscripts at the Yale Center for British Art, speaking with Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa. The exhibit, Searching for Shakespeare, is at the museum through September 17th. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now. Why do kids have homework? One author says they don't need it. Also, a singer-songwriter who's